Today is Wednesday, March the 12th, or Yud Aleph Adar Bet. This is the women's Mishnah Shir. We're up to first parak of Maseches Kedushin in the Gemara Staf Chav Tes Amid Beis.
Okay, Rabotai. We started last week the sugya of Talmud Torah, the obligation upon a parent to teach a child Torah. Tonight we're going to see another aspect of it. There are actually three or four aspects that are interesting. It's on the top of the page. Tanu Rabbanan. If you remember correctly, we had a discussion based on the sugya. If two people are obligated to have a pidyon haben, father's obligation to redeem himself and his obligation to redeem his child, which one takes priority? A similar obligation, a similar conflict will exist with the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. The Gemara had said, if you remember last week, that a parent is obligated to teach his child. If the parent is derelict in his responsibility and is not taught the child, then when the child gets old enough, he's obligated to learn himself. So now comes a situation where father recognizes that he is an Am HaAretz, and he has a child who has to be taught as well. There are limited funds in order to hire a teacher. Who do we award the teacher to in a situation of limited funds? Do we award it to Papa, or do we award it to his child? That's the sugya at hand. Tanu Rabbanan, we have learned in a brisa, top of the page. Hu lilmod, ubino lilmod. If he has to learn, and his son has to learn. Says the Tanakhama, hu kodem libino. He takes priority over his son. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, im bino zariz umimulach, if his son is quick to learn, and mimulach means salt, literally, seasoned, seasoned, it means seasoned. Mean he's got a knack for this. V'talmudo mitkayem biyado, and he will remember that which he learns. Bino kadmo. Then, under those circumstances, the child takes priority, and the teacher should be hired for the son, and not for the father.
According to whom?
What?
Who makes the decision about
this? Well, the Gemara will make that statement, that a Rebbe will make that, a teacher will make that distinction. The Gemara is going to quote an interesting story to support this notion.
Why not entertain the possibility of one person teaching both of them?
Well, that's the idea, isn't it?
Okay, because obviously when you're dealing with an adult, it's a different level. That's the assumption. The obligation to teach a child begins at what level? When is a parent great obligated to begin? It's not an age. No, it's. I should have photostated that brayta, which says katan hayodea lidaber, aviv milamdo torat sivalanu Moshe morashaki hilat Yaakov. When a child can begin to speak, that's when a parent is obligated to teach him.
That's a wide range.
That's a very wide range. That is correct. And it's a little unusual as well in terms of parental obligations of chinuch. I'll give you a very simple illustration to highlight what I'm referring to. How old do you think a child has to be in order to pick up a lulav and an etrog? How old? You pick up an esrog, lulav and esrog.
Not comprehension.
What?
You're talking about physical dexterity, not comprehension.
Yeah, just to pick it up, yeah. How old?
You could do it at 2. You're just
going to
get up.
Oh, okay. Okay. Good. Is a parent obligated to buy a 3-year-old a lulav and etrog because he can pick it up? Even if he somehow knows it's a mitzvah, what age do you think it'll be?
That he's required to buy
a lulav and an etrog? Yeah, at what age is the child? He knows that there is a mitzvah. He learned in school. He sees his parents. He knows the mitzvah.
7 or 8.
So the Mishnah doesn't say, katan hayodeya litol aviv chayav liknot. It's katan hayodeya linaneya. What is linaneya? To do the new, and that, to understand, to make the shaking in the right direction, and to understand what the Nanuim are all about. So I want you to establish a principle in a second. When is a parent obligated to purchase a pair of tefillin for a child? Not when he can wrap them on appropriately. He cannot. That's not the obligation. It doesn't say, katan hayodea lehaniach tefillin, aviv chayav liknot lo tefillin. It says, katan hayodea lishmor tfilav. Somebody, it means to guard the sanctity of the tefillin. Obviously it's a much more mature age. Because one of my grandchildren, he should be well, comes to shul on Sunday morning with my son, and he sees everybody on tefillin, so he wanted tefillin when he was 7 years old. So Tzvi saw on Amazon, you can buy boxes look exactly like tefillin with no parshiot in them. And he comes to shul twice a week. Once on Sunday, comes on Tuesday morning at 6:30 with him, and he puts on tefillin like every guy, and he barely can daven, but he wears tefillin. But that's not the mitzvah of tefillin. That's just, you know, he...
Are you going to get in trouble and be in all the newspapers?
If it would be real tefillin, I would get in trouble because it's the same issue.
No, but there's in the newspaper they made pretend tefillin, the picture of the newspaper,
right.
People wrote against that,
right.
It wasn't the right thing to do.
That's correct. So it depends what age, though. Because when you give a little kid a little, you know, lulav made out of paper, okay, for a 3-year-old, that's okay. But that's not fulfilling the mitzvah of chinuch, per se. Right, I'm not saying it's not important. It is. It's important. It is, but it's not So if you had to foster a definition of when is a parent, based on those two illustrations, when is a parent obligated to provide chinuch for a particular mitzvah? When the child reaches what age? Just add a little caveat to it. But he can do what?
Know what he's doing.
Not
remember what he
learned. No, to do the mitzvah in its entirety, the entire scope of the mitzvah. Again, lulav. If I just pick it up without waving, I fulfill the mitzvah. That's the bare bones mitzvah. But that the bare bones mitzvah is not what we strive for. We strive for what? What do we strive for? We strive for understanding the mitzvah and performing in its entirety. Same thing with tefillin. Bare bones mitzvah is to put it on. But that's not what we strive for. We strive for understanding that tefillin have a certain precious sanctity. So in the Braita, which illustrates all of the examples of chinuch unto a child, every one of those illustrations is that the parent knows, that the child knows the parameters of what he's doing. Yet by Talmud Torah we don't say when is a father obligated to teach a child when he's the brisker of, when he can. No, he's obligated when he knows how to say Torah Tzivalanu Moshe Morashakil. That's when the parent is already obligated. So just to get to my point, the father obviously is a lot more intelligent, and you can't necessarily hire the same teacher at the same time to teach an adult and a child at the same time. Yes.
Is there a differentiation between mitzvot that are you're obligated upon them when you reach a certain age, as opposed to being obligated to do them when you reach a certain understanding and ability to do it? Because there are mitzvot that, let's say, are applicable to you when you're 13. It doesn't matter what your knowledge base is.
Correct. Every mitzvah is that way. 13 is the cutoff point.
Right. So why is that a time, a specific age, and these are not ages? They're based on abilities.
No, that's for the mitzvah of chinuch. To train your child.
Abilities are for chinuch, but the actual mitzvah is...
Correct. That's correct. A child, when he's 10 years old or 11 years old, is not chayav to observe any mitzvahs. Not. The mitzvah is chinuch. But he's not obligated to do anything.
So what's the thing of being 3 years old is the age of chinuch?
Where is
that coming from?
It's... No. It doesn't say ben sholosh l'chinuch. No. No. So now the Gemara is going to give an illustration of a story where father and son had only one opportunity, and let's see how the Gemara describes the story. Line 3. Ki had the Rab Yaakov berei the Rav Acher bar Yaakov. Just as in the case of Rav Yaakov, who was the son of Rav Acher bar Yaakov. So he was named after his grandpa. Shidarei Abuha Lekame de Abaye. Rav Acher bar Yaakov placed him under the tutelage of Abaye. Abaye was considered one of the outstanding Amoraic scholars. He was known for his intellectual brilliance, for his absolute brilliance. He was known in that department. Kiata, when Rav Yaakov arrived, Chazya, Rav Acher, Abaye noticed, saw, Dulo heva mechadedin shmatze. He wasn't terribly sharp, this Rav Yaakov. He was not terribly sharp. Okay. Well, Rav Acher bar Yaakov got the report card. And on the report card, there was an anecdotal, no grade, you know, yeshiva noam style, no grade. We don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. Why give them a grade? Just write an anecdotal. Father said to him, Ana adifa minach. I'm better than you. Look at this report card. I'm better than you. Tut at. You stay here. Tuv at. You stay here. You sit here. Ve'ezel ana. And I'm going to learn with Abaye. Fine. That was the decision of the pop. The teacher had made the evaluation that Rabbi Yankala was not terribly sharp. Hence, Rav Acher bar Yaakov, who was an Amoraic sage already, said, I'm going to learn with Abaye. Shama Abaye de Koheve Oseh. Abaye heard that Rav Acher bar Yaakov was in town and now in the Beis Medrash, in his Beit Midrash. Hevehahu mazik be rabanan de Abaye. There was this demon who used to hang out Abaye's Beit Midrash. A demon who hung out in Abaye's Beit Midrash. You and me cannot understand what in the world demons are, but demons were believed in the time of the Talmud rather extensively. So much so that there are conversations between Amoraic sages and demons. All the time. There's a famous one in Maseches Chulin where an Amoraic sage is traveling and he has his backpack and he gets off the road for a second just to rest and he puts down his backpack near a drain pipe. And included in that backpack was a water bottle. And the demon punctured a hole in the water bottle. And Rav Ashi at the time asked, well, why did you puncture a hole? He says, don't you know that demons hang out by water drains? And you put your backpack right on my nose. I wasn't too happy about it. So the demon was summoned to court by Rav Ashi. Does he have to pay for damages or not? And this is half a page discussion of what the demon argued in court and what Rav Ashi responded. I can't explain it to you, but it's a fact of life that demons were prevalent in Amoraic lives.
Is that the word
mazik? Mazik here means somebody who does damage. Somebody who does that. A mazik. Right. That's a way we could. That's right. We use that
for our children.
For our children. Hamazik. Exactly. What? The decision in court was that he had to pay. Yes, he did. He was summoned to court and he came to court. He got a subpoena. And it was funny, the way he wanted to pay him was in something that was, see, today it was just, today we have just the opposite. Today there is a little curse on even numbered things. Even numbers. All right. Sephardic Jews go crazy about it. They don't do anything in even numbers. Nothing. They don't blow on Rosh Hashanah 100 sounds. It's 101. That's the only reason. Because they don't want to end off, because even numbers in the climate called Zugos had, was
connotations.
Evil spirit of connotation. Well, this guy, this Abaye knew that the Zugos have these terrible connotations, but it's funny. The demons themselves also don't like Zugos. So what happened was, Rav Ashi got smart. He wanted to pay for the damages with a pair of something. So he gives it to the demon, and the demon runs to court and says, "This is of no use to me." Rav Ashi said, "That's not my department. You know, you assessed me damages, and I have a right to pay anyway. You can't use it. That's your headache." That's how the Gemara ends. So I'm just telling you, don't be startled when you go the rest of your Talmudic life and come across demons. They are all over Shas. All over.
Can you explain? Not really. A demon is a person?
No, it's some kind of a spirit. It's some kind of a spirit that interacts with humans and whose design in life is to hurt people.
And they can come to court.
They can be summoned to court.
They can be seen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a spirit that it's like Casper the Friendly Ghost. Like he would show up in court. Just imagine Casper. You watched him, did you? Of course. So you know what he's talking about. Casper the Friendly Ghost is now summoned to court.
Casper is based on the demons.
On the demons. Okay. That's it. Yes. So anyhow, let's get to this story. So there was Hefer Hahu Mazik Bei Rabbanan de Abaye. In Bei Rabbanan is in the Beit Midrash of Abaye. There was this Mazik who used to hang out there, and he often caused damage to the people who came into the Beit Midrash. And nothing that Abaye could do could get rid of this demon. Nothing. However, okay. The chi have aili betrain, afilu be your mama have a mitzike. Afilu be your mama have a mitzike. This particular demon, if two people would walk in together, again, the zug, two people, not only was this demon capable and potent at night when all demons were working, but he was even capable during the day. That's what it says. The Chiheva Island betrayed, if you walked in with two, Trey is Aramaic for two. Afilu bi yamama have mitaske. You would get hurt, damaged by this demon, even in broad daylight, which was an unusual phenomenon. That's why he's a very powerful demon. Amaluhu. So Abaye told his Beis Medrash. He made an announcement one day before Rav Acha walked into the Beit Midrash. Before he says, what did he say? Lo leisev le'inosh ushpiza. I don't want anybody to provide housing for Rav Acha. There is an expression in Europe, be'est of kest. What is kest? That's a family that would what? Provide, a local family would provide the meals for the people in the yeshiva. And it was called Essen of Kest. And you had to be nice to those people, otherwise they would never invite you back again. Well, there was apparently this system in town where if somebody came from a different community, members of the Beit Midrash would like provide housing for him. Abaye made an announcement, nobody is to provide shelter and housing for Rav Acha bar Yaakov. We'll see in a second. Why? Efshar de Misrache Leinisa. Maybe he will have a miracle. Misrache, in other words, Abaye figured Rav Acha bar Yaakov is a real Gavra Rabba. So I'm going to have him egg on the demon. But Rav Acha bar Yaakov is going to be able to overpower him. So I'm going to put Rav Acha in danger by inviting him into this place, but I'm confident that a miracle will occur and Rav Acha will survive, and that not only will he survive, he will ultimately defeat the demon and we will excise him from the Beit Midrash.
Why would the demon be against him?
If he happened to, he'd go against anybody. If you walk in during the day with pairs, then you're even subject to damage during the day.
Because he didn't have a place to lodge.
Correct. At night, everybody is fair game, single or not. In fact, the Gemara in Bracho says that for this reason, Al Yahalech Adam Yechidi Balaila. You're not supposed to travel alone because of the demons. Demons used to attack.
Does it bother you?
It doesn't. Because you're so used to it. Right? And I have no way of explaining it, so I don't get frustrated anymore.
I was just the way.
Okay. So if Rambam writes, Rebbetzin Schachter, Rambam writes, that all these stories are demons, loyhaya veloynivra. They didn't exist. They have no power. Zero. It's here to teach us a story.
So it's a metaphor.
Correct. That's what Rambam. Now, many disagreed with him. In fact, okay, but I'll tell you something even a little more powerful. If you remember your psukim in Parshat Ki Tetzeh, where the Torah tells us that we are not to seek advice from certain the Machashefa, the Doresh Ov, O Yid Oni, Doresh El Hametim, the Chover Chover, all different types of people, sorcery in this. So the Rambam writes in his book of Hilchas Avodas Kechavim that all of this is absolute nonsense. There's no such thing as magicians. No such, people think they're machashefa. There's no machashefa. They're not. Oh, they have no power whatsoever. But they believe. They convince people that they do have.
Even to this day.
So they just. So what is the Torah telling us? So in that case, when the Torah tells us not to do so, what is the Torah telling you? Don't be a fool. That's what the Torah is saying, according to the Rambam. Don't be a fool, says the Ramban. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to put 5 averos in the Torah. 5 of mitzvahs lo ta'aseh. Not to turn to this person, not to this person, so that we shouldn't be a fool. It's obvious, says the Ramban, that these people had power. They had power. And therefore there was an enormous temptation to seek their counsel. So what are we told? I don't want you to do so. Tamim tihiyeh im Hashem Elokecha. Rely on HaKadosh Baruch Hu to do what? That He will do whatever is good for you. And if not, what do you do? What do you do? What do you do? If you need to consult, who do you consult? It's the next pasuk in the Chumash. That's correct. Navi mikir becha miachat kamoni oso sha'alta. Hear me, you're supposed to ask. Don't go to these guys. So the Ramban, also a pretty good spokesman, believes that all of these people have power.
Can I just say something? Sure. They do have power because, let's say, for example, even in medicine, you have these people who go to people who have no, like, really, it's like they're really class.
Right.
But because of people's beliefs, they, you know, there's the placebo, there's the power of the mind. So when people are unhappy or they're at a loss, let's say spiritually, they're spiritually in a bad place, in a void. If they go to these kind of sorcerer type people who still exist, the fortune tellers, the people who tell you, they do, you know what, seances, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, but do they ever get it right? Do they predict the future?
But people, sometimes you read these stories where they get it right. They like, you know, it's like a chance. But the point is that mm-hmm. that is, to me,
okay.
The whole point of that is it's away from almost Halkut Shemayim, and that you're taking away from the belief that God is in power. You're giving people power who should not have
okay,
power
and
believe
okay,
in them.
Good.
So that's where they're bad.
Good.
Because people's minds are very strong.
That's a very good point. Ramban will be very happy with that explanation.
That's why I think that we have to be warned against them, because I think this probably is a metaphor for, like, evil or...
I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. So anyhow, let's finish the story. Ol bat bahu Rabbi Rabbanan. Rav Acha bar Yaakov came. Nobody offered him what? Lodging. So what did he have to do? He had to spend the night in the Beit Midrash. Sleeping on the floor in the Beit Midrash. Idamile kitanina deshiva resh vasei. The demon appeared to him as a fish with seven heads. With seven heads. That's how the demon appeared to him. Kitanina, tanina is taninim adolim, is like the greater fish, a whale or something. What? Right, the Leviathan is a tanin, right? With seven heads. Shiva reshvate. Okay? Now comes the encounter. Demon is closing in on Rav Acha bar Yaakov. What is Rav Acha bar Yaakov doing? He's davening Shmon Esrei. Davening Marav or praying for his life. One of the two. Fine. Now, in the course of Shmon Esrei, we bow down seven times. Seven times. Says the Gemara, Kol Kriya Dekora, every time he knelt and what? Bowed down, Nasar Chadreshe. One head of the demon was knocked off. One head of the demon was knocked off. Where do we bow down seven times? At the beginning of Shmon Esrei, Magen Avraham, right? Modim. Hatov Shimcha L'chana, right, Modim. When you step back. When you step back. There are various, right, when else you do it, right?
That's very symbolic. That's nice.
Good.
As you go down to Hashem, you show that the power is Hashem.
Correct. Very good.
That's nice.
And what happens? Demon is gone.
It just happens that it has seven heads and there are seven times.
Yeah, just so happens.
Just happens.
Punk like that. Exactly. That's correct.
That could be a metaphor for the, like the Yetzer Hara in you. That could be.
You could, no doubt. Next time you give a drasha, you can use it in any way you'd like. Yeah. Any way you'd like. I'm serious. You can. You have my license. Yeah. Now, Rav Acha bar Yaakov was not terribly thrilled that Abaye had done this, and he recognized that he was set up. He recognized that he was set up. Amaluhu lemachar. Said Rav Acha said to Abaye the next morning, Ilo isrecheish nisa, had this great miracle not happened to me, sakintin. That's a sakana. You put me in danger. How did you have the gall to put me in danger and know that what? That I'm going to survive. You're not supposed to rely. Ain't somchen al anes. And the discussion ends. Abaye had no retort. No retort. So some say, now Rishonim comment and say, no. Abaye knew that Rav Acha bar Yaakov was such a great person that he knew not just it was a suffix, it was guaranteed that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would not allow him to be damaged by the Mazik, and therefore he didn't feel he was putting him to any particular danger. Okay, that's not what the Gemara says, right? Ilo Israchesh Nisa Sakintin.
Why is it
digressing
from teacher?
Yeah, I was just
here.
Why what?
Why is it digressing from teacher
to
child?
No, we're not. This is the story. It just wanted to complete the story. What was the story? How did Rav Acha bar Yaakov get down to Abaye's Beis Medrash? Because Abaye had said his son Rav Yaakov is not much of a student. So the Gemara just says, once Rav Acha bar Yaakov came down, Abaye took note of this and said, oh, I'm going to use this
time. Why did Abaye do it himself? Because he was also a heavy hitter.
No, but he did. Obviously, Abaye was there every day and God did not respond to him. So he knew that I need somebody of greater stature than I in order to counter this particular demon. So he took advantage of Rav Acha bar Yaakov by forcing him to confront the demon by making him lodge alone in the Beit Midrash and confront the demon one-on-one.
But I thought your question is, but what's the relevance of this story to the issue of who...
None.
Exactly. But that's,
there is no...
But that's Gemara.
That's correct.
That tangent...
The Gemara is... I'll tell you, I just want to finish the story. It's a fascinating story. So whoever's editing this story felt this is a great story to tell. Yeah, it says something about how really great Rav Acha bar Yaakov is. And that's why the decision, that's why his decision to reject his own son was a good one. Because who was Rabbi Yaakov? Who do you think? How old was Rabbi Yaakov at this time? He was Rabbi Yaakov. He was an Amoraic sage already. He's quoted in the Gemara. But yet, the father and the son wanted to both learn with Abaye, have that privilege of learning with Abaye. So we're not dealing with a child with, you know.
Okay.
Right. Not dealing with that.
But isn't it kind of like reminiscent of like Yaakov with Noah and like that wrestling and a test of your spirituality and what he did, that he was davening and his davening.
No doubt.
So it's kind of like...
No doubt. That's a very good point. When the Torah says, Vayeavek ish imo, it is the Medrash that says the ish is a malach.
Right, we don't know that.
We don't know that. The text says...
If indeed
he was with an angel,
right.
You read the pasuk, somebody attacked him. That's all. Somebody attacked him.
But he prevailed, and it became a big thing. That just, it was just a regular attack.
Right. No doubt.
Dealing like this.
No doubt. Correct. Good. What I'd like to do the balance of tonight. Is to see. That's great.
Yeah.
That's the way we do it today. Tell your kid he's dumb. So. I'd like to see how certain commentaries handled the decision as to why the father goes before the kid. If all things were equal, the only time that there is a discussion that perhaps child is if he has unusual potential. But if it's not unusual potential, everybody seems to say that the father goes first. Tell me why.
That he can teach the son.
Okay, it'll help facilitate that. Okay, that's one possibility.
He's old enough that he's obligated from his vote. So the more you learn, the more you... he may not be doing certain mitzvot.
Okay, look at it in terms... Ah, So what was the? Why did we decide that if there's only five silver pieces, father goes before the child? What do we say? Mitzvah de gufei. A mitzvah that is related to you takes priority over a mitzvah that applies to somebody else. Good. That would be the simple thing. I want to show you a comment by Rav Moshe Feinstein on this particular Gemara. Take page 2. Flip the page. We're on page 2. And I'm going to give you the background to what Rav Moshe quotes on the top of the page on the right hand side. This tshuva has nothing to do with this topic, and that's why it's in Eben HaEzer. It's dealing with all different types of marriage issues, things like that. Nothing. At the end, the guy probably threw in as an aside, oh, he asked me a second question, I'll write it right here also. Fine. Here is the famous debate between Ben Petura and Rabbi Akiva. Ben Petura, Pei Tet Vav Reish Aleph. You're in the desert, you and your friend, and there's only one canteen of water, and it's only enough water for one of you to survive the heat. So Ben Petura writes, you share the water, Va'al ere b'mitat chavero. Both share, both die, and therefore you will not have to witness someone else's death. So that's what he means. You have no right to drink, even though it's your water, you have no right to drink it whatsoever. Share it with the other dude, and that's it. Rabbi Akiva says, Chayecha kodmin. That even though there's always a mitzvah to promote life of someone else when someone else is in danger, your first obligation is to promote your own life. Chayecha kodmin. Hence, Rabbi Akiva says, you drink the canteen out, you walk out of the desert, he dies in the heat, and there's nothing, unfortunately, you can do about it. Logic. That if there is a mitzvah, v'chai bohem applies to you as well.
But if both of them take part
of it, they're both going to die.
You don't know.
That's the case. The case is there is not enough to enable both of them to drink. Both of them are going to die.
But what happens to chesed? What happens to...
Chesed it operates when you have to do chesed for somebody else. Your first line of chesed is to yourself. And he's going to quote several illustrations to that. Now, it's obvious that Rabbi Akiva is correct, because we've never heard from Ben Petura again. That's what I said.
Is that his real name?
That's his name. No, that was his name. His name is Ben Petura. Every time I say that in a class, the kids, they think it's very funny. Right. It could be that he earned his nickname that way. He expired. It could be. But he's known as Ben Petura. So hold on a second. I'll give you, Shari, an illustration where this halacha applies. Okay? A family is destitute. Poor. They have $5 available to purchase the next meal for the family. Somebody knocks on the door, one of our 100,000 schnorrers, and takes out the letter and the tudah from Rabbi Heinemann, from the T-neck one, everything. And Rabbi Heinemann checked off very generous donation recommended. Some guy came to me and said, Rabbi Heinemann never writes very generous. He wrote down very generous for me. So, okay. So, you only have $5. If you give away the $5, your family is going to starve. No food. What obligation, is there an obligation to do chesed and give tzedakah? Absolutely not. Your first obligation is to take care of your family. And your extended family. If you have a brother, a sister, uncle, aunt that is in financial need, it takes priority over everybody else in the community. Everybody else in the community. And it's stuck up. And people shouldn't think that it's not staka. And it's people have asked me this many, and I do this all the time. If you give a check to your brother who's in need, you can't get a disc, you can't get a tax credit. I tell people, break it out to the discretionary fund, I will write the check to the brother. I don't believe it's dishonest, because it is halachically a form of charity. It is a halachic contribution of charity, fulfilling the mitzvah of tzedakah par excellence. Fine. Says Rav Moshe, where does anybody come to think that the only time when we take your life versus someone else's life is only in the physical world? Even in the spiritual world, it's the same thing. If your life needs spiritual nourishing and someone else needs spiritual nourishing, both legitimate causes. But your spiritual nourishment takes priority over someone else's. Hence, says Rav Moshe, based on the halacha of the top words, Hadarash, look at the top words on the right hand side of the page. Hadarash Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva said, Chayecha Kodmin. 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 And there he's just going to write, well, I believe that this applies even to what? To spiritual. That's why the Gemara says, father goes first.
But father and child is different than two people in the desert.
In what this? What difference? Okay, your temptation. So here is Rabbi Akiva's challenge. Father and son are in the desert. Right. What will Rabbi Akiva say halachically should take place? Right. Drink. Most parents will probably ignore Rabbi Akiva. But they will not be following Ben Petura either. Ben Petura says, no one should, both of them should die. No one drinks the whole thing. No parent would say that either. They'll give the whole thing to the child and risk their own life. That I could hear. I don't know if Rabbi Akiva would agree with that. I'd have to ask Rabbi. It's a question. No, because I'm serious. You know, that's a different, it's an interesting question. Whenever you, when it's your own child, you have to, you know, who knows how you respond. Even halachically. Yeah.
Well, it's also the question it's a set-up story, because you're never really in that situation where you know the outcome. You don't. But you're saying you're in this situation, so both of you should die, but one should survive, and so it may as well be you. Right?
Right.
And so, but it's not as if that you could say, well, the other one should the other guy fight you for it?
No, so that no,
the canteen belongs.
Correct, correct. The canteen belonged to me. Do I have a right to drink it, or do I have to share it with him? If the canteen was just on the ground, both of us should fight to the bitter end to get that canteen, and we'd be within our rights to fight for it.
How many people have we celebrated because they threw themselves on a bomb or something? Mm-hmm. Al Kiddush Hashem. In other words, meaning to save the whole group.
Okay.
No, but that's one in a group. Ah, one.
Correct.
So the life should be known.
Okay. So if
my life any more important than your life?
So if you have, that's just it.
Because
okay, but for Chayvem is your life also.
Your life.
However, the discussion is your point. We've had this on Yom HaShoah, many such cases. The only consideration to allowing you to sacrifice is that you're going to save multiple people. Multiple people. And it's the famous Mishnah in Trumos, which addresses that issue. Right. Somebody comes and says, I want one of the women. I want to take one of the women. Or I'm going to kill everybody here. What do you do? Do you say, okay, sorry, we're not giving anybody over, and they'll kill everybody? Or do you somehow come up with a decision who is sacrificed and who gets, and then you save everybody? Or can you volunteer? There are such discussions, because the counterbalance is that they're going to spare many lives. But when it's one against one, everybody says your obligation is to save yourself. Everybody says that. Yeah.
Well, what about the idea that if I drink my canteen of water and the other person dies, I'm asking that person. It's a young person who hasn't had a family yet. I'm killing their whole family, their whole lineage.
I understand. It's, I know. Yes, dozens of such.
One against many, but like two people. Like this particular case.
Yes, he has those also.
And he ruled.
It's like he ruled like Rabbi Akiva.
You know, what he does in those types of cases is he tries to say who the halach is like. But then defend, he doesn't want to criticize somebody, you know, well, you know, I'll find somebody to rely on. But if you asked him point blank, to be perfectly honest, he would say, person was wrong. Person was wrong. He doesn't like to do that in his tshuvot when somebody engaged in an act of heroism.
Sometimes it's beforehand they're asking him.
What?
Just after, sometimes beforehand.
Okay, if it's beforehand, he will always say, Chayecha Koydman. Always. That's one possibility as to what's happening here. If you go to page 3, another comment of Rav Moshe, this is not in his responsa, this is in his commentary to Shas, called Dibros Moshe. His responsa called Igros Moshe, that's what he's famous for. His Dibros Moshe are not that well known. But here he happens to discuss this case which we just read. So we're going to read what he says. He says, Hada Amar Rav Acha Bar Yaakov Shadrei Mitchila L'Rav Yaakov Berei L'Kami De'Abaye. Rav Yaakov sent his son initially to learn by Abaye. Shelicha Ora Hahu D'Lo Kitana Kama U'D'Lo K'Rav Yehuda. He asks a simple question. Why did Rav Acha Bar Yaakov initially send a son? We had a debate between the Tanna Kamma and Rabbi Yehuda. What did the Tanna Kamma say always takes place? Father goes first. What was Rabbi Yehuda's criteria? If the kid is... Okay. So hold on. So now, the Ha'afla Rabbi Yehuda... Even according to Rabbi Yehuda, Rakisha Habein Odif Mehaav Bino Kodmo. It's only when the son is superior to the father does the son take priority. Veha Lohaya Bino Rabbi Yaakov Odif Mimenu. We know for a fact that Rabbi Yaakov, Dan Shain the Talmud Chacham, but he didn't come to Rav Ada Bar Yaakov. He didn't come to, because Rav Ada Bar Yaakov was one of the major, major commentaries. V'dochak lomar, and it is a little forced to say, Rav Ada Bar Yaakov ta'a lachshov al bino Rabbi Yaakov shehu od adif mimenu v'dai shekashehu kimoto. He said, it's difficult to imagine that Rav Acha Bar Yaakov made a mistake in assessing the intelligence of his son. Why did he send him first? Because, I thought Rav Yaakov is much smarter than I am. I don't believe that the father would make such a mistake. V'gam yikshah, t'hokvar haya bino Rav Yaakov adam gadol ma'od b'madrega amora. Who? What is this Gemara telling this story in the first place? Exactly. This whole story might be totally irrelevant to our case. Why is it totally irrelevant? Because you have to ask yourself another question which we didn't discuss. When does a parent obligation to teach his child end?
Never.
When?
Never.
Never? I don't know.
So why did he teach his child himself?
That's also a good question.
Because the original case was that he was an Amharat.
Correct. Shaharei Nikra Rav Yaakov. How do I know that he was already a person of stature? Because how do we identify him? Rav Yaakov, which was the Amoraic nickname, the Amoraic title to all Amoraic sages. Rav. V'im kein, hoya kvar baki b'chol ha-Torah. Rabbi Yaakov was already well knowledgeable in all of the Torah. Shelo haya shuv shum chiyav alo av lelamdo. The father is not obligated under any circumstances then to teach his kid. Rabbi Moshe Ano assumes that you know what the halacha is. There are those who say that father is obligated in the midst of Talmud Torah until he knows Nikra, Chumash. Once you teach him Chumash, that's it. Others say, no, he has to know Mishnah too. Well, Rabbi Yaakov far exceeded Chumash and Mishnah, in which case, this whole story is just totally irrelevant. Totally irrelevant. So what's the issue at hand here? They have to pay tuition for one of them. Who's going to enjoy the shiurim of Abaye? That's all. Who's going to enjoy the shiurim of Abaye? Imagine somebody has to, had to go to YU. So you have a great Rosh Yeshiva and a Rosh Yeshiva's son, and they both want to come to learn to the Rav. If YU would charge tuition, who should pay? But it's not a conflict of the mitzvah of chinuch of Talmud Torah, asks Rav Moshe, and he's got a good point. V'ulay yesh lomar, so Rav Moshe answers like this side of the room. Ulay yesh lomar, the mitzvah yesh ala'av l'lameid b'no moreh le'olam. Maybe all of that which I hope you knew, that a father has to teach his child Mikra, father has to teach his Mishnah, that's the minimum requirement. Not the maximum requirement. Minimally, a father has to what? Has to teach his child Mikra, according to one opinion. Minimally, according to opinion number two, he has to teach a Mishnah. Then the father's got to go to work. He can't spend his whole life teaching his kid. But in theory, the mitzvah is to teach your child le'olam. Af kishikvar habein hu gadol batorah. V'nimtza shehem shavin le'inyin she'ika mitzvah arabacha hu ba'atzmo u'bino. So now we're dealing with two mitzvot. Not the mitzvah upon teaching your child, but what's the conflict here? What's the conflict here? Each one's chayv in the midst of Talmud Torah. Who is going to have the right to a better Talmud Torah shir than either the father or the child? In which case, it's very much analogous to what? To other situations when there are two mitzvot, one related to me, one related to someone else. Who has a right? Whose mitzvah should you attend to first? Mine. My son has to learn. He wants to go to the Rav Shir. Be my guest. I also want to go to the Rav Shir. I take priority over my son. But it's not within the category of what? Of the normal construct of parent who struggle with a parent who's a son and a child who's a little kid who has to study. Under those circumstances, there's only one real obligation. That's to teach your child. That's your primary obligation. Teach your child. So Rav Moshe says the story here is not exactly analogous to what the Gemara intended. The Gemara intended a question of who, two people, who lilmod and no lilmod, but it creates the impression that they're both ignoramusai. Rav Moshe says no, that's not the case, this particular case. They're both well in the realm of Talmidei Chachamim. Just becomes a simple question of what? I want to learn, my kid wants to learn, beautiful mitzvot. So here, I have a right to decide, this is my obligation, I have a right to take a mitzvah for myself, above and beyond my child. Yeah.
Why did he send his son in the first place?
What?
Why did he send his son in the first place?
Because Rabbi Yehuda, that's a good question, he doesn't answer that question. Okay, so that initially in his question he assumed, how could Rabbi Yaakov have made that mistake? How could Rabbi Yaakov have made it? That's a good question. That's a good question. However, he answers that question. He said, Do I have a right to be mochel, something that is due me as a parent? I have a right to be mochel? Of course. I can be waive my right. You're right, it's my right to what? To go to the shir. So what did he intend to do? Simply wanted to waive his right on behalf of his son as long as he would prove to be his equal. If he would be his equal, father would be willing to be mochel, his right, and pass it on to his child. The moment Abaye sent the progress report home and said, it's not nishta shah from cup, then father said, no. I'm not waving on my right for somebody who is an average dude. If he'd be a real, then I'll do so. That's how Rav Moshe handles this particular sugya. Reb Chaim comes up with an incredible insight. Incredible insight. Go to page 4. Yes.
Would the time consideration be in the case where the father has less time, theoretically, because he's older, so therefore the son can take care of his obligation later in life? Or you could argue exactly the opposite, where the son should be getting it from an earlier
time. Right. It would be an interesting way to make that distinction, but the Gemara doesn't. Just as the Gemara in the desert situation did not ask who's the older one. Mm-hmm. You know, the two guys are dead. One can be 90 years old and one can be 12 years old. There's no such discussion in the Gemara who gets the water bottle.
And therefore the assumption is it doesn't matter?
That is correct. Because had that assumption been made, it should have been recorded in text. Hani mili, when they're approximately the same age. I don't want it. It should have, or some Rishon should have said that. It doesn't seem that they are saying that. Says Reb Chaim the following. And I'll give you the emphasis. It's a rather long situation. I just want to give you his sharp analysis. Can you think of every single time the mitzvah of Talmud Torah is discussed in the Torah? Not that often. Think of the Shema. Vishinantam levanecha. Next. Velimadetem osam es b'neichem. So how does the Torah always formulate the mitzvah of Talmud Torah?
Parents of parents.
Always to teach. Always to teach. Right? Says Reb Chaim, when you're learning for yourself, when you decide, you're also fulfilling teaching. You're teaching yourself. The mitzvah is always the same mitzvah between the father and the child. The father's obligated to teach his child, and the father learning himself, what mitzvah is he fulfilling? Teaching himself. Teaching himself. So the conflict resolution is at least on the same page. When you don't hear Reb Chaim's thought, you actually are approached with two different mitzvot when the conflict between parent and child arrives. Namely, the father's mitzvah is to do what? To learn. This father's obligation vis-a-vis his son is to teach the son. That's two different mitzvot, theoretically. So when you come to Pidyon HaBen, what is the mitzvah when it came to redeem the father? And the mitzvah is the exact same mitzvah? You bet it's the mitzvah of Pidyon HaBen. So our Gemara, which follows on the heels of that, has never seen a discussion where there is a conflict between observing mitzvah A and the other person of mitzvah B. That's not, you know, that's not, it was the same thing by Brit Milah. The child who grew up recognized he was not circumcised, and he had a child, he has to circumcise his kid. He's dealing with the same mitzvah of Brit Milah. But if the mitzvah of learning independently is called a mitzvah of Talmud Torah, which we call it, Limud, and the mitzvah to teach your child is defined as a mitzvah to teach, then there are two different wavelengths. And it's not a conflict. Hence, Reb Chaim says, there is never a secondary definition of the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. The mitzvah always is to teach, never to learn. To teach. When you learn yourself, you are fulfilling the mitzvah of teaching. Teaching yourself for the purpose of what? If the mitzvah is defined as what? As teaching, what is an underlying principle of the mitzvah?
You're learning and you're learning to teach.
Correct. So say it in broader terms. Learning is designed to do what? To pass it on to someone else. Ah, that's correct. Put your mask on before your kid's mask. That's good. I like that. Yes. I like that. Okay.
But it's not. My idea is that, so then you can help and you have the capacity to help.
Right.
Person.
Correct. Right. But at least the discussion here is on the same plane. So we now have two people who are faced with the mitzvah of teaching. Do I get priority to teach myself? Or does my son get priority that I have to teach him? Teach him. And these words are so matim for Rab Chaim as it was expressed verbally, or he read this in the whole Rav's life thinking. People, you ask the Rav, how come during the summer you can't sit and relax and learn alone in your house? Why do you have to have students come with you a whole summer? And that's what he did. The Rav, he learned a lot. But his life was never devoted to learning for himself. Everything was to teach. Just look at the life, the schedule that he lived. Tuesday morning, he flies in from Boston. He gave a shiur from 11 to 2. Tuesday night, sit in Maria from 8 to 10. Every Tuesday night. Wednesday morning, 11 to 2. And we always used to joke around, why did he end a little after 2 o'clock? Because he had a deal with the greasy spoon on that lousy restaurant, because the cafeteria closed at 2 o'clock. So greasy spoon probably gave the Rav a kickback to keep the shiur going, so the people, only a joke. But so Thursday, 11 to 2, fly back to Boston in the afternoon. Saturday night, on a Matzah Shabbos. Everybody knows the Saturday night shiur in Maimonides. A couple of hundred people would come, collegiates from all over the place. Sunday morning, Chevra Shas in Maimonides. Do you know, does what he did in Maria? It's unbelievable. At the end of the summer, every single year, for the last 15 to 20 years of when he was well enough, at the end of the summer, 3 days a Yarche Kala come to learn with the Rav in Boston. It was unbelievable. He didn't have to travel. He was much more relaxed. He was in his hometown. So we came to him. Stayed in a motel. Took a topic for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. The first day you got there, shiur started at 3. From 2 o'clock, we go to 5. The next day, he went from 9 to 5 with a break for lunch for an hour. The next day, from 9 to 3 straight, and then he sent you home. It was Gan Eden. It was Mamish Gan Eden. But his whole life was devoted to teaching. He never really felt comfortable sitting alone in his apartment just learning for himself. It was just so abundantly evident that he fully digested Rab Chaim's halachic analysis and incorporated that into his own life. And as I said, every summer he invited a group of students, even when his wife was alive. They went to Onset, to this resort in, I don't know where it is, but Cape Cod, and with students. And after she passed away, he invited them to Boston, and they learned in Maimonides in the school. They share a whole summer. Wholesome. All right, we'll stop here. We continue next to Bach.
Next time.